This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Congolese economy has a lot of problems, and that is one thing that voters in 2023 are thinking about. I think for most Congolese, the main issue, especially for people in the urban areas, young people in the urban areas, is unemployment.
That's John Makum Mbaku, a Brady Presidential Distinguished Professor of Economics and Senior Fellow at Brookings, on some of the issues being raised about the DRC's upcoming presidential election. Details coming up. Also, the World Bank has approved debt relief for Somalia. And Ethiopia's peace minister has been fired and arrested. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story for some African delegates at the COP28 climate change conference that ended in Dubai today, the biggest advance has been an agreement to establish a loss and damage fund. This would commit richer countries whose burning of fossil fuels has contributed the most to global warming to compensate poorer regions like Africa for destruction from climate change. Environmental activists say Africa's biggest producers and users of coal, oil, and gas also remain unwilling to commit to phasing out fossil fuels. Darren Taylor reports.
Mohamed Addo is a climate change policy expert who heads Power Shift Africa, a think tank based in Nairobi. It raises awareness about what Africa needs to survive and even thrive as rising temperatures spawn extreme weather events and cause suffering across the continent. At COP28, Addo spoke on panel after panel with a few key messages. One is that developed nations, who are largely responsible for climate change, must help Africa build the infrastructure necessary to adapt to and mitigate against the effects of droughts and floods caused by temperature increases. Give us the means to help ourselves, says Addo, by funding drought-resilient crops and strong dams. He also wants richer nations, like the United States and China, in cooperation with African governments, to fund the continent's move to start generating electricity using green energy, like solar. Addo believes it's possible for Africa to industrialize using clean energy. Some countries, like Kenya, he says, are leading the way by generating most electricity from non-polluting sources.
The continent of Africa is the least responsible for climate change. We all know we're suffering faster and worse the impact of climate change. But that continent that is poor and has over 600 million people without electricity, a billion people without access to clean cooking, wants to lead the world. It means something for the most affected geography and the least responsible to want to chart a different path, not just for Africa, but to inspire the world.
At COP28, delegates from some of Africa's major fossil fuel users and exporters, including Nigeria and South Africa, made strong arguments that they be allowed to use their vast oil and coal reserves well into the future. Addo says they don't trust the richer countries to compensate them for keeping their coal and oil underground. They also argue that green energy isn't sufficient to boost African development. Salim Fakir, executive director of the African Climate Foundation, told an Atlantic Council event he understands their position.
People want specifically a rapid phasing out of oil, gas, and coal. The continent is still needing a lot of cheaper energy sources. I think the question for the continent is, what does it do with its vast fossil fuel reserves? Here you'll see a lot of political tension around what the transition on the continent looks like.
Tunisian economist Fadel Kaboub told another UN panel, Africa will only succeed in its climate ambitions if global institutions and powerful economies cancel its debt. He says Africa could then switch to renewable energy rapidly and build necessary infrastructure and capacity to thrive in a hotter world. At COP28, Kenya's climate envoy, Ali Mohammed, told journalists Africa will continue to be ravaged by extreme weather events as long as it owes so much money.
A number of bridges in Kenya that were initially constructed using debt have been washed away. And Kenya has to borrow money to rebuild our infrastructure, our electric infrastructure, our road infrastructure. And that is the problem.
Kaboob says debt cancellation is a giant leap, but one that's entirely justifiable given the severity of the crisis facing Africa and the world. He points to Germany as an example. After the Second World War, half of the European nation's debt was written off. That, along with a globally supported program to industrialize Germany, helped it develop into one of the world's great economic powers. Kaboob says the same is possible for Africa in the form of a continent-wide just energy transition. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
British lawmakers voted 313 to 269 yesterday to support the government's revamped plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, but it still faces further wrangling in the coming weeks. The UK Supreme Court ruled 4 weeks ago that the original plan is illegal, saying Rwanda is not a safe destination for refugees. The policy has angered human rights groups and cost the UK at least $300 million without a single flight getting off the ground. The vote averts a defeat that would have left Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's authority shredded and his government tittering. But the safety of Rwanda Asylum's immigration bill that Rwanda and Britain recently signed faces criticism both from conservative centrists who think it skirts with breaking international law and from lawmakers on the party's authoritarian right who say it does not go far enough to ensure migrants who arrive in the UK without permission can be deported. After threatening to block the bill yesterday, many of the hardliners abstained in hopes of toughening it up later in the legislative process. After the vote, Sunak said on social media that the British people should decide who gets to come to this country, not criminal gangs or foreign courts. U.S. officials say America has struck hundreds of deals worth $14.2 billion with African nations over the past year as Washington tries to counter growing influence on the continent by China. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more from Washington.
The 547 new trade and investment agreements represent a 67% increase on 2022 in the number and value of closed deals, according to British Robinson, coordinator for the U.S. administration's Prosper Africa Trade and Business Initiative. Robinson says the Presidential and National Security Initiative is aimed at strengthening strategic and economic partnerships by mobilizing two-way trade and investment flow, and young people are key to realizing that goal, she says.
The continent is home to the world's youngest population, an asset that creates significant opportunities for viable business deals that create jobs and foster shared prosperity.
Judd Devermont, President Joe Biden's top Africa advisor, says it has been a record-setting year for U.S.-Africa relations, with the United States following through on its commitment to invest some $55 billion over 3 years.
As we wind down 2023, we have already delivered on more than 40% of this commitment. In fact, by the end of year two, we anticipate surpassing 70% of our goal.
Devermont and Robinson were speaking at a virtual media briefing yesterday, marking the one-year anniversary of the Africa Leaders Summit in Washington, where Biden pledged to go all in on the continent. The announcement comes as Washington works to deepen its engagement with Africa, where China has been expanding its influence with infrastructure investment, loans, and other moves. Devermont says Africa is not only important economically, but politically, adding that the U.S. has been pushing for more African voices on the world stage for some time now.
President Biden last year called for the African Union to become a permanent member of the G20, and in September, we proudly welcomed this development. We're now advocating for a third seat for Sub-Saharan Africa on the IMF board, And of course, we reiterate our call for permanent representation for Africa at the UN Security Council.
Jonathan Pratt, the State Department's Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs, was asked about investment and trade in countries of conflict or other crises like Sudan.
The goals of the AFCFTA to unite 1.3 billion people in a single market and to create a nominal GDP that's larger than India's is a huge boon. And in that process, harmonizing regulations, reducing trade and non-trade barriers, that will benefit all countries, whether they are experiencing crisis or not.
Devermont says in places like Niger, one of several countries to be hit by military coups and violence on the continent, the U.S. is prioritizing peace through negotiations. He says the U.S. is also looking at the underlying drivers of conflict and is investing in new approaches, including elevating its focus on elections and corruption. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
The World Bank has approved debt relief for Somalia, and the IMF is expected to follow suit today. World Bank country manager Christina Svensson says the move will allow Somalia to have its debt forgiven by both bilateral and multilateral creditors, dropping what the country owes from $5.2 billion to around $600 million. Svensson told VOA Somali Service that it will give Somalia a fresh start and send a very important signal to investors. The debts are from before 1991, after the state collapsed. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Ethiopia's peace minister has been fired and arrested for allegedly having links to an outlawed rebel group after he made a series of social media posts criticizing the government. Federal police released a statement yesterday accusing Taye Denda of collaborating with anti-peace forces that are trying to destroy Ethiopia and of belonging to the banned Oromo Liberation Army. Taye, an ethnic Oromo, according to the Associated Press, is a senior member of the ruling party but has grown increasingly critical of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Last week, Taye blamed the government for the failure of recent peace talks with the OLA and condemned a decision to ban an opposition rally in Addis Ababa, the capital. On Monday, Taye posted his dismissal letter from Abiy on Facebook and described the prime minister as a barbarian who plays with human blood. There was no immediate response from the prime minister's office. In a sign that the United States is getting increasingly concerned over the number of civilian casualties from Israel's military campaign in Gaza, President Joe Biden delivered a public rebuke to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, even as he maintains staunch support for Israel. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wida-Koswara has this report.
Another market destroyed in Gaza, this one in the Jabalia refugee camp. The level of civilian casualties is making U.S. President Joe Biden increasingly concerned.
We have made it clear to the Israelis and are aware that the safety of innocent Palestinians is still of great concern. And so the actions they're taking must be consistent with attempting to do everything possible to prevent innocent Palestinian civilians from being hurt, murdered, killed, lost, etc.
Israel is losing international support over its indiscriminate bombings, Biden said during a campaign appearance earlier Tuesday, his sharpest public criticism. According to a White House transcript, he said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu needs to change his coalition and empower the Palestinian Authority to become a partner in the peace process. He singled out Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gavir, who opposes a two-state solution. Biden's comments came as 153 countries voted overwhelmingly in support of a UN resolution demanding a ceasefire. 10 countries opposed the measure, while 23 abstained. Riyad Mansour is Palestinian permanent observer to the United Nations.
Our duty is to try to save the lives who are still alive,
by having this resolution adopted and by forcing Israel to comply with it, and those who are shielding Israel to comply with the global consensus.
The vote followed a similar UN Security Council resolution Friday that failed due to a U.S. veto, a position that critics say damages Washington's interests beyond the Middle East. Former U.S. diplomat who resigned in protest over U.S. policy in Israel, Josh Paul, via Skype.
But also where we are arguing, for example, in the United Nations to gain the support of the Global South for our condemnations, our just condemnations of Russia's abhorrent invasion of Ukraine. We are also going to lose votes if we are seen to be hypocritical, if we are seen to be walking away from our values.
General Assembly resolutions are non-binding but carry political weight. Richard Gowan, UN Director of the International Crisis Group.
UN officials, the majority of UN member states, are simply looking for every means possible to create a sense of moral pressure on the US to change its posture.
Israel and its supporters say a ceasefire will only benefit Hamas, allowing them to regroup for future attacks on Israel. Julie Raymond, Managing Director of Policy and Political Affairs at the advocacy group, the American Jewish Committee, via Skype.
It's allowing Hamas to have a legitimacy that it hasn't earned. It's giving trust to terrorist leaders who have proven unequivocally that they are not trustworthy.
Following Hamas October 7 attacks in Israel that killed at least 1,200, responding strikes by Israel in Gaza have killed more than 18,000 people by Palestinian count in the bloodiest campaign of the decades-long conflict. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The South African government says it plans to build new nuclear power stations amid an energy crisis in the continent's most advanced economy. The move to invite bids yesterday was immediately criticized by the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, which said Russia's state-owned nuclear agency, Rosatom, was the government's preferred partner. Government officials did not name any potential bidders and only outlined the start of the process. The criticism was linked to a major nuclear deal that South Africa signed with Russia in 2014 that was shrouded in secrecy and allegations of corruption. It was cancelled by a South African court in 2017. Numerous other African countries have been linked with nuclear power agreements with Russia. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Electoral Commission says President Felix Tshisekedi is seeking re-election alongside 23 other candidates next Wednesday. They include Nobel Peace Prize winner Denis Mukwege and the runner-up in the 2018 presidential election, Martin Fayulu. John Mukum Mbaku is a Brady Presidential Distinguished Professor of Economics and John S. Hinckley Fellow at Weber State University. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. In discussing the election with me, he says the opposition is strong but fragmented, greatly favoring the incumbent.
I think that the incumbent, Felix
Tshisekedi.
Yes, most Congolese are not very happy with his performance during the last few years, since 2018 when he became president. That election was considered unfair, and a lot of people in Congo believe that that election was stolen from Martin Fayulu. The Catholic Church in Congo actually believed that Martin Fayulu was the one who won the election, but that the outgoing president, Joseph Kabila, had manipulated the process to bring in someone he could control from the background and continue to influence power in Congo, and that was Felix. And so that is a problem that still continues to affect Felix today.
How about the country's economy, Professor? Couldn't that be a factor in the election?
The Congolese economy has a lot of problems, and that is one thing that voters in 2023 are thinking about. I think for most Congolese, the main issue, especially for people who live in the urban areas, young people in the urban areas, is unemployment. The unemployment rate is very high. Extreme poverty is a significant problem. Then you have food inflation, which was exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, and also COVID. So these problems are going to be serious issues for the incumbent president. However, during the last couple of years, Mr. Tshisekedi has introduced universal free primary education, and many people in Congo look at that as something of a great achievement on his part. In addition, he has he's offering free medical care, free health care to women who deliver children in public hospitals, something that, so those two things work in his favor. Now, the third thing that works in his favor is the fact that the opposition is quite divided. You have very strong opposition candidates. And so what is going to happen is that those candidates might divide the vote and allow the incumbent to win. And so if the candidates, this very strong candidate, this very strong opposition candidate, if they had sat together and decided to combine their efforts and put in just one candidate, I think that would have made the elections very, very competitive. So you have Moise Katumbi, who was the former governor of Katanga province. During the time he was governor, he did a lot of good things there. He improved the economy significantly, improved the tax collection system significantly, and provided a lot of economic development in that region. In addition to that, he is the owner of a football club that is very popular in DRC. And so he is viewed very positively, not only in the province of Katanga, but also throughout the country. Then you have Martin Fayulu, who is believed to have won the 2018 election. He is a former ExxonMobil executive. And you have Dr. Denis Mukwege, the 2018 Nobel Prize winner. He is well known for his humanitarian activities. He's done a lot of work in helping women fight sexual violence, especially in the eastern part of Congo.
There are 24 candidates in the field, including Denis Mukwege, the Nobel Peace Prize winning gynecologist, as well as Martin Fayulu, former the oil executive from whom the presidency was widely seen to have been stolen in 2018. There are 24 candidates, but it's a fragmented opposition. In cases like that, it greatly favors the incumbent. One more thing, Professor. Anzuluni, one of the candidates, Floribert Anzuluni, actually claims 15 of the candidates were created by the regime.
Well, it is possible, because this is a practice that is quite common in many countries in Africa, where the incumbent tries to divide the opposition by creating non-viable opposition candidates so that they could siphon votes away. And this is a big problem in Congo, where you don't have a second round of election, where the person who gets the majority of the votes, regardless of how much the majority is, even if it is under 50%, that person will go on to become president without a second round of votes. And so under those conditions, the fragmented opposition is very favorable to the incumbent.
That was John Makumbagu, a Brady Presidential Distinguished Professor of Economics and John S. Hinckley Fellow at Weber State University, speaking with me from the U.S. state of Utah. Meanwhile, one of the main opposition candidates for Congo's presidential election next week, Moise Katumbi, suspended part of his campaign today after violent clashes at one of his election rallies. Live rounds were fired and several people were injured as Katumbi addressed supporters in the coastal town of Mwanda yesterday, marking an escalation in tensions ahead of the vote. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.